Welcome to Christian Medical and Dental Association's chapel. We trust this message will encourage your walk with the Lord.
I wish I could be there this morning, but I can't, and I guess Zoom comes in handy from time to time. I wish I could have more time to talk about what I do as a Southern Regional Director, but I love this role, and I tell people all the time, outside of my family, honestly, this is the single most rewarding thing I've ever been a part of. So I love being in this role. Yeah, it's been just over 7.5 years. And one of the things that I get to do in this role, as Bill said, is travel and visit our campus ministries across the Southeast. And one of the things I've noticed as I've talked to students is that they tend to feel like their Christian student club is out of place. Like it doesn't quite fit or belong with the other student interest groups. I'm sure you know that most of these schools, actually all of these med schools and dental schools, they have student interest groups. And in medicine, there's a surgery club and a pediatrics club, et cetera, et cetera. And then to our students, a lot of times it just feels like, the religious people, what are we doing here? How do we quite fit with this medical school environment? When I, on a related note, when I started with CMDA in 2017, I remember looking up several of our doctor members online when I didn't know who was who. And I do remember that a lot of them would mention CMDA on their CV, or at least in like the About Me section of their website, especially if they were in private practice. And I'm pretty sure it was Dave Stevens or Gene Rudd that told me when I started that most of our docs used to be a lot more outward facing with their CMDA memberships. They took pride in it and they would look for chances to bring it up. I don't see that as much anymore, unfortunately. And I think that part of the reason is because science and medicine in the US at least are trying to push religion out. Maybe our whole culture is, but at least especially science and medicine, it's like religion is irrelevant, distracting, or at worst, maybe it's at odds with sound medical treatment. And I just wonder how many, like what percentage of our students and doctors feel like outsiders for being a follower of Jesus Christ in an academic setting. So that is the motivation for this talk that I put together. And there are a couple ways that I like to encourage our people. I'm going to try to share my screen here. Let's see. I'll assume that's working. Okay, looks like that's up there. So the first thing that I like to think about and remind our people is that throughout human history or the history of the church, Christ followers, they've always felt like outsiders. Like this place, this world, this life wasn't all that there was and wasn't where we're meant to be ultimately. And so if we feel like we don't quite belong in our, vocation from time to time, I think that's okay. I think we're in good company. But secondly, and despite a lot of thinking this, I'm really not willing to concede the point that religion does not belong in healthcare at all. I mean, let's just start with hospitals themselves. I'm sure you've noticed that many hospitals are associated with or even named after Christians or Christian denominations. And I used to work personally at Emmanuel Hospital. I also worked at a Mercy Hospital. This is back in my Nebraska days. Currently, I live in Fort Worth, Texas, as you know, and JPS or John Peter Smith is a very well-known hospital and health system. Well, John Peter Smith was the actual guy was a Christian. And you just think about the hospitals as we know it. I mean, when was the last time you were driving down the street and saw the new Atheist Memorial Medical Center? No. And even if you did see that place, you wouldn't want to go there. A few weeks ago, I was in Houston, and maybe some of you have heard of MD Anderson. That guy, Monroe Dunaway, fun fact, Anderson was himself, surprise, a Christian, et cetera, et cetera. Jackson Memorial in Miami, the founder was a Christian. Ochsner in New Orleans, which kind of dominates that whole health scene, that man was also a Christian. Well, maybe this is all a big coincidence, though. It just so happens that these founders of major medical centers and well-known physicians in our country were Christians. It's not a coincidence, friends. And here's one of the reasons why. And this is a book I read a few years ago. According to Gary Ferngren, as you can see there, he's the foremost expert on the history of hospitals. He writes, "The hospital was, in origin and conception, a distinctively Christian institution rooted in Christian concepts of charity and philanthropy. There were no pre-Christian institutions in the ancient world that served the purpose that Christian hospitals were created to serve. None of the provisions for healthcare in classical times resembled hospitals." So the point here is the hospital, as we know it today, was a Christian innovation. And this is because the whole idea of caring for the sick in the our wider community, people have always cared about their families, of course, but caring about other people in the community, in town, in the city, it's just a fact. It did not arise from atheism or agnosticism or Greco-Roman paganism. It actually came from Jesus of Nazareth, motivated by biblical teachings like the Good Samaritan in the Gospel of Luke and Matthew 25, when Jesus encourages caring for the least of these. So this is the hospital as we know it, but it's not just hospitals in this country that were founded to serve people and to honor God. Actually, you may not know this, but all of higher education in this country was exclusively Christian up until about 1850. Like every single higher education building and program was founded to be Christian. Princeton, Dart Brown, Dartmouth, I mean, these were all established by conservative Christians. Duke, for instance, was endowed by James Duke, who included this with his initial statement: "The aims of Duke University are to assert a faith in the eternal union of knowledge and religion set forth in the teachings and character of Jesus Christ, the Son of God." Now, our area director in that area, in the Triangle area, is Corey Whitaker, and he could tell you that this is not part of Duke's purpose now. It's changed a little bit. Harvard, another great example, established in 1636 by Puritans. Its mission statement was, listen to this, just imagine if this was Harvard's goal today. "Everyone shall consider as the main end of his life and studies to know God and Jesus Christ, which is eternal life." And I don't know if you can see it on the bottom, but you compare that today when about 40% of Harvard students identify as atheists or agnostic. 40%. That's about double the average percentage of students at other universities identifying as atheists or agnostic is about 20%, and Harvard's double that. And Harvard was established to train ministers for the gospel of Jesus Christ. So ultimately, whether it comes to science, medicine, higher education, and you guys all know this, what we are seeing is the removal or the attempt to remove our spiritual roots from all these institutions. And when you remove our spiritual roots, you also remove what we would consider basic morality. This whole idea, this whole push, has been described in a really powerful quote. And that is why I named this talk Cut Flower Medicine. And it comes from this particular man, named Will Herberg, who was a Jewish philosopher and author. And he writes, listen to this quote, let this sink in. The attempt made in recent decades by secularist thinkers to disengage the moral principles of Western civilization from their scripturally based religious context in the assurance that they could still live a life of their own as humanistic ethics, that has resulted in our cut flower culture. What does he mean by that? He says, so this is severing a flower from its stem. That's what he's talking about. He says, cut flowers do retain their original beauty and fragrance. You know, so the idea is if you cut a flower off, it looks identical, smells the same, looks the same, feels the same as it did when it was attached. But not for long. And this is true only so long as they retain the vitality that they have drawn from their now severed roots. After that is exhausted, they wither and die. And so it is with freedom, brotherhood, justice, and personal integrity, the values that form the moral foundation of our civilization. Without the life-giving power of the faith out of which they have sprung, those things possess neither meaning nor vitality. This is exactly what is happening now. So many smart people in academia feel like they can just gut or eviscerate all idea of religion, whatever that may mean to them, and they can still retain kind of the fruit, the flower that our culture, that a country founded on biblical principles has kind of, you know, given birth to. And that's just not going to work. And we're already seeing signs of erosion today, aren't we? This is one book that I read a few years ago. It was recommended to me. It was a New York Times bestseller for years, actually. I don't know how many years, but it was multiple years. Sapiens by Yuval Harari. And this is what one part of a larger book. Yuval says, like it or not, we are members of a family called the great apes. There was nothing special about humans. The most important thing to know about prehistoric humans is that they were insignificant animals with no more impact on their environment than gorillas, fireflies, or jellyfish. So basically, we are big, complex gorillas and fireflies, at least as this man sees science. If I was there, I'd love to know how many of you have heard of Peter Singer. Peter Singer is a philosopher and author. He was a long time, I think he retired last year from Princeton, but he was there for 25, I think he was there for 25 years. And the New York Times called him perhaps the most influential living philosopher. Now, if he's the most influential living philosopher, I want you to hear some of his ideas that relate to science and the human species. First of all, he says that Charles Darwin's theory undermined the foundations of the entire Western way of thinking about the place of our species in the universe. Elsewhere, he writes, being a human does not mean that we should give the interests of that being preference over the similar interests of other beings. And you can probably draw out some implications of that, but here's a direct one, so you don't have to think too long about it. He says flat out that the life of a newborn baby is of less value than the life of a pig, a dog, or a chimpanzee. He's not ashamed about that. By saying this, he's been interviewed and asked multiple times about it, and he has this whole philosophy. It's built up that basically he says that if you prioritize the human species over an animal species, he says you're guilty of speciesism. He has a word for it, speciesism. I don't know if he coined that or not. So the idea, you know, just like you could be guilty of racism, which is bad. He says if you prioritize a human baby over a chimpanzee, you're guilty of speciesism. You know, the kind of underlying worldview that we have really does make a difference, and it really does play out in some important ways in medicine, which I'm going to get to. But then one more man that I'll quote, Charles Zucker, who's a genetics professor at Columbia. He says, in essence, we, that's human, the human species, we're nothing but a big fly. Now, if you believe that, that opens up all kinds of doors to do things, to believe things, and that is what we're going to explore now. I know this is an unfortunate and but still classic example of what happens when medicine can be hijacked and co-opted. This is a book, the things that I'm going to say in the next few minutes is from a book by a Jewish psychiatrist named Robert Lifton. This book was recommended to me several years ago by Dr. John Patrick, and he recommended too many books to me, but this was one I actually read, and I saw all kinds of parallels to today and applications, if that's the right word, that I want to draw out from reading this book. So this book was called The Nazi Doctors, Medical Killing and the Psychology of Genocide. And I want you to think about how this relates to, again, an underlying worldview and what happens when God is completely pushed out of medicine. So why did the Nazi doctors participate in medical killing? I don't think many people have reflected on this or even know or understand why they would do such a thing. Okay, like they were, you know, they didn't just all just fly out of the pit of hell one day. You know, I mean, they were people with families and careers and jobs before the Nazi regime kind of took hold and started those atrocities. This is one of the doctors writing in 1940. This is what he said. This is what they were doing. He said, it must be the duty of racial hygiene. Think about that term. It must be the duty of racial hygiene to be attentive to a more severe elimination of morally inferior human beings than is the case today. We should literally replace all factors responsible for selection in a natural and free life. In prehistoric times of humanity, selection for endurance, heroism, social usefulness, etc., was made solely by outside factors. This role now must be assumed by a human organization. Otherwise, humanity will, for lack of selective factors, be annihilated. What he's saying is that in former times, you know, cavemen and all that, you had survival of the fittest, you had natural selection, you had nature rooting out the inferior people and species and beings, but that was so slow, it took too much time. Now, we need to be the ones to actively root out those people who are defective and who are inferior, whatever that may mean to them, or else our whole species is in jeopardy. That's what he's saying. This is why they were doing what they were doing. At least that's what they said. Guys, one of the things that really struck me about this book is that what the Nazi regime was doing in the final solution, as they called it, when they were killing so many, is that they thought and believed that all of this stuff was healthcare. That is what they said. The Nazi doctors viewed their concentration camps as a public, quote, public health venture. And this is why they only allowed doctors to select inmates for the gas chambers. They call these selections when these train loads of people would come. Doctors were there always to greet them and to assign them their place. The final solution in Nazi Germany all stemmed from their views of science. And that all of this was healthcare was the justification for all their horrors, killings, medical experiments. Without a transcendent God, if matter is all that there is, how could unacceptable, we'll say, as what Nazi medicine did would be to many physicians today? How can we call anything that they're doing, you know, bad science or bad medicine when it kind of makes sense, actually? You know, if there are some inferior people that are just going to drag down and hold back human progress and the human civilization, why would we waste our time and waste our resources helping the terminally ill, for instance? I mean, if you just think about it with that kind of worldview, we're just nothing but complex bugs. What's wrong with this? There's one might even say this was just consistent science and sound medicine. One Nazi doctor, this is one of their doctors, said all the Nazi message was, what the Nazis were saying, all our killing is medically indicated and carried out by doctors. Doctors. How could they justify this? Well, they redefined who's human and who's worthy of life. And I'm sure you're already drawing, parallels between today's healthcare and medicine and what was happening there. In their minds, mental patients especially lacked human qualities. And they had a phrase which is pretty grotesque. They called them useless eaters. So mentally and physically handicapped people were useless eaters. And I have a sister-in-law. Her name is Whitney, and she would definitely be considered one of those by these doctors. She has a syndrome called Rett's syndrome, which is very rare, but she is now I think she'd be about 38, and she's never walked or talked or fed herself or, how is she helping humanity? How is she furthering human progress? How is she advancing the human species or race? She's not at all. There's no contributions being made. Why would anyone, it's just concerned about, humankind and science and scientific progress. How do you pull out compassion and patient care and the justification to expend all kinds of resources on a person like that? You don't get those qualities of patient care and compassion and love from a test tube. You don't see those in a laboratory. You don't see those in a medical textbook. They're not there. They don't come from quote-unquote science or the scientific method. These are deeper realities, guys. They're deeper. That's a deeper foundation that forms and shapes what we think is good healthcare. It matters. It absolutely matters. The Nazis had a phrase for such people, and that was a life unworthy of life. I don't speak German, but I'm pretty sure it was lebensunwertes Leben. A life unworthy of life. Gee, are there any examples we can think of, guys, where the medical system is saying, yeah, it's a life, but it's not really worthy of life if the mother disagrees? And I just put a comment here that a mother's womb should be the safest place for young life, but instead, statistically, the mother's womb is the deadliest place a baby can be. But as long as we just call it healthcare, right, that just whitewashes everything, as long as people just use that term, I guess everything is okay as long as we call something healthcare. And this is exactly why I'm using the Nazi regime as an example, because it wasn't a million years ago, and it's too pertinent. Listen to what one Holocaust survivor had to say. I think this is powerful, guys. When I talk about this after 35 years, she writes, or she said this, and the psychiatrist recorded it. She says, "I think, how could it be possible? But I believe they were no longer doctors. They were SS officers. In these things, the group spirit is 1,000 times mightier than the individual spirit." And I know I don't have a lot of time, but I want to press a couple things here. This is powerful. And what this is saying is groupthink is an incredibly powerful force and can lead people to do all kinds of things that they wouldn't necessarily do on their own. And you take these Christian medical students and you put them in med schools, and all their smart professors and all their faculty members and people around them are acting like, well, of course, abortion and transgender care, yeah, this is just good science. It's just good medicine. You know, of course we should remove body parts from healthy individuals. Just people saying that and believing that, it messes with people's minds and it causes them to do things and believe things that they wouldn't otherwise do. And I think this is one of the reasons why CMDA is so important. I mean, we provide that network and that community of a ballast of something of a sound, you know, counter way of viewing medicine and life that is needed. Without this, this is the way medicine is going, guys. Groupthink. Dr. Rudolf Rahm, a faculty at the University of Berlin Medical School, he said that each doctor was to be no longer merely a caretaker of the sick, but was to become a cultivator of the genes and a biological soldier. And then lastly, one survivor concluded that the killing program was led by doctors from the beginning to the end. Guys, this is an example of what happens when medicine is hijacked and co-opted and godless and built on a foundation other than faith and scripture. And this is my last slide. You know, obviously, even non-Christian doctors are appalled, and probably many would be offended by the comparisons between abortion and transgender care. But the reality is, they can't say that's bad medicine. There's nothing about those acts that the Nazis were doing that they can say was bad medicine. They may say that's bad morals, but that's not science, is it? And then the question is, where do they get their morals? They just make them up. What they were doing was fully in accordance with Charles Darwin's ideas. Actually, they were far more consistent. They were trying to help the human race and not waste resources on those who were inferior. And if there is no God, a lot of what they did makes sense. So, cut flower medicine. Do Christians belong in healthcare, in medicine? As we invented this, this is our world. This is what we began, not only in science, but also all of higher education in this country. Do Christians belong? Absolutely. We belong in healthcare more than anybody else. I wish I had more time to go further directions, but I know this is a little heavy, but thanks for listening.